Do you accept your karma or do you change it? Do you try to change it? Can you change it? Is attempting to change it part of what is? Where do you stand in relation to it? It's interesting because we've grown up with such a conceptual overkill. We're always thinking what we ought to do and then doing it before we're really ready to do it. We're always a little ahead of ourselves. We overthink all the time. And there is a way in which when you slow down into what you are, out of it comes the next action, which may well be an action that is designed to change you. But most of us are living in, I ought to change myself. I should change myself. I ought to follow the spiritual path. I should. And there's that lovely expression, I'm tired of being should upon, which is this sort of, I'm tired of being constantly not at home in the universe. And what I'm suggesting is the appreciating of your fullness of your predicament, of the whole gestalt of the moment, out of that comes an act that is true dharma, that is truly appropriate. Most people don't wait for it. They always are ahead of themselves, which is their karma. I mean, that's also what's happening too. Acceptance is the ground against which leads you into the changes that are necessary. It's interesting. I had the experience where I was sitting in a hot tub in New Mexico with a Tibetan nun and Allen Ginsberg. And it seems an unlikely combination when I think of it. And I was really very happy. We were all happy. And I got a telegram from Suzaki Roshi, who I'd only met once for a few minutes, saying, we have a space for you at Mount Baldy for the Rohatsu Dai Sesshin, which starts tomorrow. Now, I didn't apply. The Rohatsu Dai Sesshin, for those of you that don't know, is this really fierce Zen sitting where they beat you. You know, if you do anything, if you move, they beat you. And they give you these koans, these insoluble problems, and they make you look like a fool because you can't solve them. And it's a hell realm. And nobody in his right mind would ever go to it. And there I was sitting happy with my nun and Alan and the tub and a long, lazy afternoon, and this telegram arrives. Now the telegram is part of the existential situation. And it's extraordinary that within an hour, I was packed and off to Albuquerque to the airport to go. And I didn't even want to go. But it was just, that's exactly what I needed at that moment, and I was willing to do it. Now, I don't remember it being almost at the level of, I think I'll get behind myself and push. It was like responding to a hunger. It's like, I really feel that people get ahead of them, that right effort is misunderstood oftentimes. And it's like, pardon my crudity, but you know, when you need to go to the toilet, you really need to go. You don't have to decide, is it philosophically wise? You don't have to decide. I mean, it's just timely to go. And I really would like the spiritual practices to come out of that, because what I've seen historically is a tremendous amount of what looks like phony holy. People getting ahead of themselves in order to appear to be doing practices because they think they ought to, which has a kind of a pendulum swing of reactivity in which they then go backwards, and you see somebody that you saw all in white doing all these incredible practices, then you see them at the local bar, and then a few years later you see them, you know, a little haggard trying to find some spiritual practice, and you see that kind of go back and forth. And I am of the school that tends to push people back into the world all the time, rather than saying, come on, do spiritual practices, saying, don't bother, don't rush, you know, go be horny for a while longer, there's no rush, it's okay. Because I really want it to come out of that hunger in people. You know, there's a thing of I should meditate, and then there's the other one. It's like Ramana Maharshi didn't eat, and people said he was fasting. He wasn't fasting, he just wasn't eating. And that's the distinction right there. Now, it's a peculiar thing when you think of the spiritual journey, because most of the time we are so grounded that we're trying to get out of it. And then you start to get out of it, and then there's a period where you start to lose it and you can't get back. And that's an interesting period. And I don't want to underestimate it or underplay it. It doesn't mean one should be frightened in anticipation of it. Like if you're doing deep meditation practice, there are times in that when there is incredible fear, when the whole universe of form starts to dissolve and you're frightened. And you go to the teacher, and the teacher senses where the fear is and how to work with it. We hold ourselves in so tightly to being efficient, effective, responsible, good, that it's extremely hard to deal with these kinds of states. And yet here we are attempting to awaken, and at the same moment, if we awaken too far, we start to lose our ground, and our health insurance goes unpaid, and so on. So this is something each of us has to deal with. And what that fear is reminding you that it's not yet time. It's like those people that have out-of-body experiences, where they go out of their body, like in a near-death experience, is a good example. Near-death experience, and they go and they meet all their mishpacha that have died before them. They meet all the, you know, their old friends and spiritual mentors, and they're floating out there, and it's beautiful. And then they say, "Go back, you haven't finished your work." Or they come to a fence, and they got to go back. Or suddenly they see the doctor pressing on their heart, pulling them back, or something, and they realize it's come back. And they often come back very depressed, because it was so great, and what am I doing here? You know, like, how, what a horrible thing. And you've got to realize that this is not nothing. We in the West socialize the spiritual process to make it as non-scary as possible. But it is profound.
To see the difference between things is wisdom. To get attached to preferences about it comes out of fear, which comes out of separateness. A judgmental mind is usually motivated by fear. Discriminating mind comes out of wisdom. The transformative process of spiritual work is reawakening to the innocence of going behind that model that one had, that cut oneself off, that made oneself a tiny little fragile somebody. And a lot of the power preoccupations that we end up having, especially the power of trying to leave something behind in the face of death, is the feeling of our own fragility. And if you look at social structures, you see how much social institution is based upon the feeling of fragility of the human condition. So how you deal with fear, because you say, "I'm afraid of that person." I mean, you say, "I'm afraid of being socially shamed." But when you are socially shamed, it hurts, and then here we still are. You're afraid of violence, and then if violence happens, sure, it's scary and painful, and then behind it, here we are. And often, the fear feeds upon itself, and we're almost afraid of the fear, or the fear is the thing rather than what we're afraid of. We're just afraid. We're just afraid. We just feel very vulnerable. The ways of dealing with it. See, in a therapeutics tradition, what you usually do is try to figure out what you're afraid of. Another technique is this witness, which merely sits with the fear and tries to get it before it becomes so consuming that there's no space left. There's usually a little space left. The image I usually use is, if you have a picture frame, you got a painting of a cloud, of a gray cloud against a blue sky, but you only had one picture frame and it was a little too small. So what you did was you bent the canvas around to frame it, but in doing so you lost all the blue sky. So you ended up with just a framed gray. Right? It fills the entire frame. So when you look around, you say, I'm afraid, or I'm depressed, or something. If you enlarge the frame so there was a little, even just a little bit of that kind of round thing of a cloud and a little blue space, you'd say, ah, a cloud. Right? That's what the witness is. The witness is that tiny little blue over in the corner that leads you to say, ah, fear. I've talked about the woman calling me in the middle of the night many years ago. And she said, I've taken LSD and I'm going to commit suicide. And I'm going crazy. I've gone crazy. I'm going to commit suicide. She called me from California to New York State at 2 in the morning. So I got up and I said, yes, okay, you're going to commit suicide and you're crazy. And it's dawned on me, I said to her, look, you're obviously too mad to talk to. Could I speak to whoever it was that picked up the phone and dialed 7 numbers plus an area code to get me? Because whoever that is obviously got all their marbles, and I'd like to talk to that person, see? See? And in a way, that's the witness of the rest of it, see? Like, I'll dial him and tell him I'm mad, you know? It's like, and in a way, that's the little blue sky, and that's what we have in us all the time. Often we get so frightened, we can't stop for a moment to notice, there's fear, because it's consumed us. So the art is to keep cultivating that witness, continuously cultivating it in all the opportunities you have, so that it is present more and more of the time. At first, it's there about 1% of the time, and all the rest of it's there 90%, 99% of the time. But over a while, it gets so that it's there almost 50% of the time. And then as you start to go into these things, here comes fear. Here comes depression again. And when you focus on the witness rather than on the fear, you see that there's a part of you that is not afraid, that's just noticing it. The noticer isn't judging it. It's not trying to change it. It's not even afraid. It's just noticing. Like somebody comes in and says, I'm depressed. I said, are you completely depressed? Yes, I'm completely depressed. You're absolutely sure you're completely depressed? Yes. At this moment, as you're telling me you're depressed, are you depressed? Well, no, I'm just telling you I'm depressed. That's the one, right there. That's the one.
You get to the point where you weren't awakened, you were just plodding along, suffering, getting pleasure, suffering, pleasure, suffering, and looking this way, and then something made you look that way, and you saw that it was possible that you had something else going here, that you were somebody other than you thought you were, so now you're here, and this is real, but you start to reach up. Now, forget up. I mean, up is, of course, a metaphor. In, down, out. You start a... the problem with this business. But you start a reach. And the place you're reaching from is the physical, psychological, social plane. That's where your reality is. Where you're standing. Where your reference point is, where's reality for you? Now, as the evolution goes on, that shifts until pretty soon the free being, you go from standing here, leaping up and then falling back like a bird that can't quite fly. And we're making little attempts. As the process works, everything changes because you're no longer standing here going there. You start to stand out there looking back. And then everything is quite different. And then ultimately you hear the statement, there is nowhere to stand. That you can't stand here and you can't stand not here. It's what, when the Tibetans say nirvana and samsara are one, they say to call it form, it's the form that's formless. It's the formless that is form. It's the place where the paradoxes come together. To realize that anywhere you're standing is short of what the game is. You're not free as long as you think you're standing somewhere, as long as you're somebody standing somewhere. Now imagine just what it feels like. I mean, I play with the edge of it, of who am I? I'm nobody. I don't know what I am. I'm a whole set of projections. I'm an unfolding karmic predicament. How do I deal with this? It's extraordinary. And most of the time, I am still so caught in one desire or another that it seems real. Until somebody comes along and helps me out. It might be a book. It might be a quote, it might be a friend, it might be a meditation, it might be whatever. It might be a giggling picture of my guru that says, boy, you're really caught in that one, aren't you? You really think you're real, don't you? And there's this process of slowly, slowly realizing that you are free. That you don't have to be. I mean, everybody always asks, what will you be when you grow up? And the realization, you won't, so it isn't. You know, it isn't relevant. And that you don't have to define yourself. You're continually in a process of growth and evolution. Any label you put on yourself is such a bad trip you're laying on yourself, no matter how good it is. You know, I go to borders when I'm crossing borders and they say, write down, what is it, you know, what is your profession? I don't know, what's my profession? You put down mystic, you don't get into the country. Put blank, you know, no religion, you know. So you put author, lecturer, but what is it? I watch, like when I work with dying people, you know, I come in and there was this woman here in Marin. She was a lawyer, and she was dying of cancer. Some of you may have known her. And she had three children. She was a young woman. And they asked me to go and see her, because I'm, you know, one of the Mr. Death. And so I came, and I drove on the freeway. It was Christmas Day, and I came in, and the family acted like Santa Claus had just come, you know. Oh, you've come. Wonderful. She's upstairs. And I no sooner had my coat off that I was propelled upstairs and into this room with this woman who can't speak and who's right at the edge of death. And I'm still on the freeway. I mean, I'm, you know. So I sit down and I start to do good, which is what you do. You know, you go into your, I'm Mr. Death. I'll be helpful and I'll, you know, help you die. And it took me about 5 or 6 minutes before I looked into her eyes and I realized she was just waiting for me to finish my routine. She was way beyond that. I was so busy being somebody doing something that I couldn't even hear her. And then slowly I quieted down and quieted down, and we just went out together. Until who's dying and who isn't dying and who's helping who and what is all this about? What nonsense. At that moment, then you begin to see how when you're free of standing anywhere, you become an environment for someone else. Let me put it the other way. When you're standing somewhere, you constantly need to use the world to reinforce the reality of where you're standing. Like if you're a therapist, you need a patient. Really hard to be a therapist without a patient. I mean, you've seen them. They walk around looking for patients all the time. And it's true of any role, any single role you're in. You always need the complementarity or the symbiosis or whatever it is to make it real. You constantly have to do that. So you're constantly, the minute you define yourself as something, you're constantly manipulating the universe to reinforce the reality of that. I'm a beautiful woman, I'm an aging man, whatever it is.
But if you're standing nowhere, and you don't need to be anywhere, then you can be in this position of listening. And you can allow people to do their projections without you thumbing through their projections to find out which one you need. So that you listen and you create an environment for other human beings with your mind that allows them to be who they need to be.
You know, you're not really my child, you're another soul. Stop acting like my child. What do you think, you're my mother? You know?
Come on, you've milked that as hard as you can, let's go. I mean, you can feel how you really can't lay trips on people about their need for role, but when you are an environment that isn't caught in yours, you are a space in which if another person wanted to come up for air out of their roles, out of their identity with anything, there's nothing in you that'll jam them back down in. I mean, I think back with horror to the way in which I was a psychotherapist. I was so needful as a therapist. I needed to have patients. I needed them to need me. Oh, God, they had to need me. If they started to stop needing me, I got very punitive. You didn't get cured around me. You were always about to get cured, and you were always very appreciative of how I was helping you. Yeah, I mean, people knew their role, they knew their part if they wanted to stay close to me. And I was so afraid of being a patient myself that, I mean, we had to clearly define who sat on which side of the desk. I mean, it was not a simple thing. It wasn't like, of course, that was 30 years ago. Things are different now. But as you extricate yourself from these identities, from these roles, you learn how to wear roles, to use them, to function within them. You and I have to meet through role. Humans have to meet through roles. The question is, who's caught in what? How you can be in a role and not of it? How you can be in the role? Like, I'm lecturing in your audience. But you don't have to be busy being an audience.
I'm an audience. Yeah. Well, I'm a speaker.
Yeah.
I'm not speaking, you're not audience. We're just beings being together, and it just happens the vehicle for us being together is there's speaking,
and there's listening. The minute you become the listener, you make me the speaker. The minute you identify with your role, you make me an object. The minute you don't identify with your role and I don't identify with my role, how many of us are there anyway? There's only one of it. There's one of it playing with these different forms. So that as you get into meditative practice, you begin to examine what roles you're really caught in needing. And you begin to feel where the aversions and the attractions are in your own mind. That's the whole process of meditation, is to extricate yourself from these clingy things that are models and habits of thought and definitions until they come very, very lightly. If I'm representing the Seva Foundation, I am a foundation representative. But when I'm lying around in the hot tub, I'm not a foundation representative. I'm somebody lying in the hot tub. And I move from moment to moment to moment. And Gandhi gave that incredible, that little story that I've told so many times. It's so powerful for us in this culture. When he was leading the march, it wasn't the Salt March, it was another march, and he saw there was going to be violence, and he said he was going to stop the march, and the people, his lieutenants said, "You can't do this, Gandhiji. People left their jobs to follow you. There's thousands of people involved." And he said, "God is absolute truth. I am a human. I only know relative truth, and my understanding of truth changes from day to day, and my commitment must be to truth, not to consistency." Now you just look at your life and ask, how much is your commitment to consistency and not truth? How much, in order to make it all run smooth, are you just who everybody expects you to be all the time? How consistent are we? How afraid are we of inconsistency? Now, to be truthful, does it mean to appear inconsistent? The answer is no. Because once you know you're nobody, then you can be anybody. Then you can be consistent all the time, because it doesn't matter to you. But as long as you think you're somebody and you're consistent, you're trapped. Is this too weird? So it's really, it's why I call that the spiritual journey is really going into nobody training. Wavy Gravy, dear and wise being who's on the Seva board. You know, for a number of years, he's run a campaign each election of nobody for president, because nobody can solve our economic problems, and the essence statement of it is nobody cares. And there's so many levels of double entendre in that statement. Because somebody always wants what they need in order to preserve their somebodyness. And in fact, nobody does care. It took me a long time to realize that. So what I'm experiencing is, the less I define myself, the more available I am to other human beings. The less I am living within the box of my self-definition that constantly uses the universe to reassure me of who I am. And the more flexible I am, so that am I a student or am I a teacher? Am I a child or am I old? Once I understand what I've just been saying, and I'm just beginning to understand it myself, then my actions every day, when I meditate or contemplate or reflect back on the day that I've just completed, it's really useful, I'll tell you, it's useful to have some quiet alone time. Not and grab a television or grab a book or grab a newspaper. Just sit. If you want to sit under a tree, fine. If you want to take a walk, fine. Just some quiet time where you digest your life experiences a little bit. Because you're so busy having them, and they're not quite digested, and then you go on and collect more, because we're so addicted to more adrenaline rushes before we've even digested what we've got. And you run around like ill-digested stuff in your intestines all the time, the intestines of the mind. And sometimes when you quiet down, like I look back over a day, and I see how many times I got caught in being somebody. Because you may be going along nobodying your way down the street, and somebody comes along and they have such a clear projection of who you are, and you fall right into it. You buy right in. And what I do is, when I walk around people and they project onto me, which their projections are coming out of their desire systems, that's not coming out of anything else, I try on the projection and see how it feels. And sometimes I grow from it, and sometimes it's irrelevant, and it just goes by me, and it doesn't make any difference. And sometimes I work with it. Now, what you find is that most people are carrying their history so heavily on their backs, their child abuse, their childhood abuse, their ethnic oppression, their something, that they can't come up for air. They're too busy being somebody, the result of all that. And I watched in my own, over these past 25 years, how my personal history started to disappear. How who I was less interesting. And I watched, there was a moment, this was 10 years ago, when I decided, I moved a lot because I'm a wanderer. It's a sect. I mean, I'm a legitimate wanderer. I'm not just an irresponsible wanderer. And but I'm a Western wanderer. I don't have a begging bowl and a loincloth. I have a car, and then I usually have a U-Haul truck following me that has all my boxes of who I am. You know, and now and then I look in the mirror and I see this huge truck following me, and I think, and you know, the funny thing is it's all in boxes and they're all sealed. I never open the boxes, but I put them in the basement or the garage, and then there's my somebodyness. And I figure, you know, you take photographs and old love letters and things like that, because later you'll want to go back. And then I thought, why will I want to go back? When will I want to go back? Am I going to run out of the moment? You know? And I saw that I was protecting my history, this kind of sentimental glop thing that I was kind of wallowing in. And so I said to everybody, we'll have a big fire and we will burn my history. So we had this. Well, the first night, I put it all out of the trash. Then I found in the middle of the night, I was out going through. I woke up thinking, oh my God, I'll never see that picture again. And I went out and had to go through, you know. So I decided, no, I have to burn it. So I started to burn stuff. And then I noticed that I was building a little pile on the side. Like a pictures of my guru. You're going to burn the pictures of your guru? You think that's wise? And I can feel, I mean, I still have boxes. The new boxes are collected now. I'm going to have another fire. It's so subtle to watch this stuff and to watch the stages one goes through where one is trying constantly to be somebody in the world and at the same moment integrate the awakening that's happening into that somebodyness, and how as time goes on, and partly it's my age, I mean, as I get older, the whole somebodyness is less interesting to me. And then I start to find myself floating out more. And it's interesting that in India, they have articulated the stages of life so clearly as the ashramas, so that from 0 to 20 you're a student, from 20 to 40 you're a householder and your job is to make money and to support people and to raise your family, and then 40 to 60 you make pilgrimages and you start to do spiritual practices as well as phasing out your business and turning it over to your children, and then at 60 you become a sannyas, you just give up everything and you're a free wanderer. Well, I was 60 a month ago. Now what? See? I mean, I love my MG. Could I be a sannyas with an MG? It's orange. Now, let's assume that most of us are not totally unawakened. We are a little awakened, probably. It's about the best I can say for us. You know?
most of us are not feeling the pull. What happens is the further you awaken, the more the pull to be free gets stronger and stronger. The more it gets stronger and stronger, the less relevant is all the stuff of the world. I'd like to read you, this is a letter. I suppose most of you have heard of somebody named Swami Vivekananda. He was probably the chief disciple of Ramakrishna, who was a great, great Indian saint. And Vivekananda came to the West, and he did a tremendous amount of teaching at a time when Eastern philosophy and mysticism was really not very much known in the West. But he came, and he had a lot of charisma, and he was a very good teacher, and he's written some extremely lucid books enunciating different forms of yoga. And he died very young, actually. And this is about 8 years before he died. And it's a letter he wrote to Miss Josephine McLeod. Here he was connected to Ramakrishna, who was a great, great devotional yogi. Great devotional yogi. He said, "After all, Joe, I'm only a boy who used to listen with rapt wonderment to the wonderful words of Ramakrishna under the banyan tree at Dakshineshwar. That is my true nature. Doing good and so forth are all superimpositions. Now I again hear the voice, the same old voice thrilling my soul. Bonds are breaking, love dying, work becoming tasteless. The glamour is off life. Yes, I come. Nirvana is before me. I feel it at times, the same infinite ocean of peace, without a ripple, a breath. Since the beginning of this year, I've not dictated anything, you know that. I am drifting again in the warm heart of the river. I dare not make a splash with my hands or feet for fear of breaking the wonderful stillness that makes you feel sure the world is an illusion. Behind my work was ambition. Behind my love was personality. Behind my purity was fear. Behind my guidance, the thirst of power. Now they're vanishing, and I drift. I come, Mother, a spectator, no more an actor. Things are seen and felt like shadows." Now, it's interesting. Here was a person that we in the West looked at and said, look at all he accomplished. And here he is very honestly sharing the places from which he accomplished all that. And yet, there are beings who go through that stage and are completed. He wasn't a completed being. He's still on the journey there. There are beings that go through that, and then they really aren't here as personalities, and yet they are extremely potent, effective entities in the world. But there's nobody there. And then they are, in a sense, acting out of collective karma rather than individual karma. They're acting out of the existential situation that elicits their response rather than, I want to do it, or I need to do it, or I desire to do it. I'll read you one more quote. This is a quote from Kabir, the poet, Sufi poet. He said, "Dancing is no longer for me. The vessel of desires is broken. Parts enough have I played. God's name alone I now have. By Ram's grace I have found my full reward."
This is the end of Side 3. Side 4 is already queued up for your listening.